Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson.
Leading health centers again in research and teaching and that. I do think that one of the things we saw in the two commission that you referenced in the introduction is that the food production system, or especially in the animal sector, has been really, you know, kind of like a military-industrial complex, you know, to use that phrase from President Eisenhower, that there's a business model that dominates the production system, and that's the large-scale meat production operations. They have the resources to fund the research to perpetuate that model, which you can't, I'm not criticizing a group for wanting to perpetuate its business model, but then they also influence the research that's, you know, done in other areas, and they have a strong influence on Capitol Hill. So you've got that, like the military-industrial complex, you have kind of the agro-industrial complex, and I think you're seeing really a lot of it's consumer-driven. They're wanting more information, and I think that's what's kind of opened the door for groups like the Center for a Livable Future.
Bob, let's talk about to what extent we are worse off or becoming worse off than we were with these new models of food production and livestock production. I mean, what examples do you see that are signs that we're heading the wrong way?
Well, I think probably the most glaring example is the routine antibiotic use that really is required in a lot of these large operations to compensate for overcrowding of animals and you know, the poor waste management that's a part of them. And according to FDA statistics, about 80% of the antibiotics sold in the country are used in low-level routine daily doses in food animal operations. And the Pew Charitable Trust has done a further kind of review of that that shows a large part of that are antibiotics important in human medicine. And so you see things like infections that are harder to treat, hospital stays that are longer because of infections that are harder to treat. We've got a fellow here, a Center for Livable Future fellow who now has received her PhD that did a study in Pennsylvania, an epidemiological study that showed if you live near a swine spray field, which is the common method of disposal. The waste is collected in a cesspool, and then it's transported out and sprayed on fields in the area. If you live near one of those, you're three times more likely to have a methicillin-resistant Staph aureus or MRSA infection than if you don't live near one. So, and even then from the consumption side, we see issues with some forms of cancer being related to processed meat consumption, hypertension, and obesity. So I think the evidence is getting stronger all the time.
Well, in the case of the livestock waste, I mean, we've always had livestock, and they've always, there's only been waste, and they just put them in manure spreaders and take them out and put them on their own fields. I grew up on a farm myself and, you know, spent probably after school and most weekends cleaning barns and putting them in manure spreaders. But you're talking about that in the larger confinements, then that it's, it goes through slaughter floors, it drops underneath the confined barns, and it's kept in these pools. That, and it's actually the application of, apparently for this new study, the worry that you're near that area, that the liquid spray that's kind of more of an aerosol than what might have been in the past, either just dropping it from manure spreaders or what we strangely called honey wagons when they started doing this and dropping it directly on the fields. That might be getting into too many details there, but is that kind of it? It looks like this approach that's kind of a more of an aerosol that you know, spraying gets into the air, that might be spreading the MRSA contamination.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you've done a great job explaining kind of the systemic or systematic differences between the way livestock used to be produced and the way it is now. And the other component of it in previous production systems was that the animals could be, especially hogs and beef cattle, Iowa a few years back. His name's Jude Becker, and he's trying to maintain, he's a fifth-generation farmer. He's trying to maintain that kind of traditional production system from when Roger, you and I were growing up, and he actually rotates his hogs around and does the work of rotating the hog houses around. There are enough for a couple of, big enough for a couple of sows and their litters, but he has to move them from field to field, and they're obviously not stable, large barn, but he has to use a very large piece of equipment to kind of forklift type thing to move them around. So going back to the traditional ways is very work intensive, I'm not nostalgic about cleaning out the barns when the wind's howling from the north and there's snow in the air. That's absolutely true.
Well, I hope that you talked about many of these others are able to make it work. One thing that happened to all the farmers around me growing up, I mean, they all got out of business. And what I got down to was the demands of scale, the prices weren't high enough. Obviously, if you raise a couple thousand hogs a year, which used to be a decent number of hogs, but you raise a couple thousand hogs a year and you make $20 a head if you're lucky, that brings in $40,000, which maybe you could have lived on back then. Today, if you raise a million hogs a year and you brought in $20, that's $20 million. And, the scale just became impossible because the prices weren't high enough for people to stay in the business unless they get larger. So won't that be part of the issue, too, even to this type of systems that you're describing, that they're going to have to get, reasonable prices?
That's exactly right, and I think that some of the producers that are able to make it outside the kind of existing industrial model, like the Nyman Pork Company, for example, they're able to market their product at a premium, and not everybody can afford it, and that does present an issue. This young man I mentioned markets exclusively to higher-end restaurants and over the Internet. So this is a very different business model than the average, the typical, family farmer who's...
And this comes back to the areas of Baltimore that you were talking about. You've got some areas that are really in low-income areas, and it gets back to the issue of guilt. Some people said, well, how are we going to feed the world? Well, certainly we need to be concerned about feeding the world, but we've got to be concerned about feeding all parts of Baltimore or Chicago or Detroit or, anywhere you can say that need to have food affordable. Does that kind of get the broader than your responsibility? I know you get involved in policy, but how do you kind of balance that? And on the one hand, you see the downside, the risk of being driven for production. But that is a model that's lower cost, if you will. And that's another whole issue, whether it covers all the cost or not. And yet the affordability issue for people both around the world and in the neighborhoods that are stressed.
No, that's a very good point. And that's why I think that the conference that you and I attended where we met, the Tricost Supermarket Food Conference, I think that's why that type of investigation is important, because are we paying really the true cost of the production of that product at the grocery store, or are we picking up, and is society picking up some of the costs through higher health care costs or environmental damage that is affecting large communities? And so it's a very, I think that's the importance of answering that question. If you captured those costs, that the healthcare costs alone were reflected in the price of meat, what would that look like in comparison to more sustainable production? But it still is a huge issue for people of moderate incomes, and it's one that I think, as
suggest to people that have concerns? I mean, how do they approach their grocery list, approach them when they're going out to eat? What suggestions do you make to them?
Well, I generally recommend that people really ask questions of their, if they're at the grocery store and they're at the meat counter, ask questions of the butcher behind the meat counter. If you're buying stuff that's in a cold case, understand as much as you can about the brands that are being sold and what they do to produce the meat that they're packaging.
Thanks for joining the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to listen regularly on SoundCloud or iTunes to Farm to Table Talk.